Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And after 2 weeks, prosecutors are expected to rest their case today in former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort's trial. It is the first trial to come out of Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. But as you probably know, the trial is centered on Manafort's personal finances. So what can Manafort's finances suggest about Russia's influence in the 2016 election? And how might this conviction, if there is one, impact the more politically oriented investigation? You know, at one point this week, the judge even stopped a line of questioning because it touched on the Trump campaign and the prosecution objected. So joining me to talk about the latest developments in the trial and what might be ahead are Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Marritz, co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast. Ilya attended the dramatic and confrontational Rick Gates testimony, at least the cross-examination was confrontational this week. Hi, Andrea. Hi, Ilya.
Hey, hi, Brian.
So, Ilya, what was that like? Since they don't allow cameras or microphones in federal court, set the scene for everybody.
It was pretty exciting to see Rick Gates walk by and let himself into the witness box. He is an athletically built guy. He had shaved his beard, so he is now clean shaven. And in the direct examination portion, it was really just running through dozens and dozens of exhibits, bank records, companies that had been set up in Cyprus, establishing the facts of these payment systems that Gates and Manafort had set up so that they could take large amounts of money from their Ukrainian clients and allegedly conceal that income from federal tax authorities. Then, when it turned to the cross-examination in the afternoon, that's when things got contentious. Gates had been giving one-sentence, one-word answers just to help the prosecutors sort of make their case. When Kevin Downing, Paul Manafort's attorney, took the stand, he immediately went in and started to needle Gates on his character. He talked about Gates' other life. And Gates readily admitted having had an affair in London years earlier. He tried to establish that Rick Gates, far from being a trustworthy person, had in fact stolen from Paul Manafort. He actually got Rick Gates to say the words, "I embezzled," from Paul Manafort. I'm paraphrasing, but mm-hmm. Gates did not want to say, "I embezzled." And after being, badgered a little bit, he did concede that point. It was, you know, for a trial that is about tax fraud and bank fraud, there was not really a sleepy moment.
And we should remind people, if they haven't been following the details of this, and I know there are some Manafort trial geeks out there who are 10 steps ahead of this early part of the segment line of questioning. And anybody is welcome to call in with a question for Ilya, who was in the courtroom those days this week, or another question or observation about the Manafort trial and its implications. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Again, just for context and background, Rick Gates, who was one of Paul Manafort's former deputies, was also deputy campaign manager of the Trump campaign when Paul Manafort was the campaign manager. And Rick Gates stayed on with the campaign way beyond, through the end of the campaign and a little bit beyond that, even after Paul Manafort was forced to resign during it in 2016. So, Andrea, what were you watching for here? Because I know your interest is in figuring out what the relevance, because really the listeners, they don't really care about whether Paul Manafort committed financial crimes. They care what it has to do with the Mueller investigation of Trump.
So I think one of the things that was very striking that came out this week in Rick Gates' testimony, in addition to all of the testimony in trial, the special counsel's office is releasing every evening all of the exhibits, hundreds of pages in many cases each day. And one of the exhibits that they introduced and that there was actually a little bit of testimony about was that Rick Gates and Paul Manafort were not only advising the campaign of this Ukrainian strongman, Viktor Yanukovych, but they were working for his government as policy advisors. So up until 2014, the two men who were the campaign chairman and the deputy for President Trump were actually working for a foreign government, one that is, you know, as the jury doesn't know this, but we know that after his term in office, Yanukovych fled to Russia. He was driven out by his own people, and they found this tremendous corruption and looting. So it builds a larger narrative. I mean, it is really extraordinary. And I think that,
you know, another little thing that might not be such a little thing that was also buried in the testimony that day, Rick Gates said that one of the people who had signatory authority over some of these offshore accounts of Paul Manafort's was Konstantin Kalimnik. Konstantin Kalimnik, is a Russian-Ukrainian national who was one of Manafort's right-hand people in Kiev. Kalimnik is widely considered to have probably been or maybe still be an agent of Russian intelligence. So having Rick Gates say that on the record is a potentially pretty big deal. That's a yet another strand connecting Trump back to Russia.
And we saw in The Atlantic that Rick Gates once boasted to a group of Washington lobbyists, quote, "You have to understand we've been working in Ukraine a long time. And Paul Manafort has a whole separate shadow government structure. In every ministry, he has a guy."
In every ministry in the U.S.?
Well, I think in Ukraine.
In Ukraine, yes.
Shadow government.
Well, I mean, I think it is entirely clear that, you know, Manafort, I mean, we've seen memo after memo, even though the judge has been strictly limiting this. Manafort had a literal direct line to the president of the Ukraine. I mean, the other thing you mentioned is, are people interested in his financial troubles? I would argue that they should be, because one of the things that we've learned, particularly this week and in graphic detail, is how desperate Paul Manafort was for money after he lost his client in Ukraine. So this is the bank fraud part of the trial. There was evidence that was introduced not just through Rick Gates, but also through documents that he was minimizing the amount of debt he had so that he could get even more loans, that he was maximizing the amount of profit he had so he could get more loans. Yesterday, it came out that he had sent an email to his son-in-law saying, pretend you are living in our apartment, which is on Baxter Street, excuse me, on Howard Street. There's another one on Baxter Street, but on Howard Street in Soho. When the appraiser comes, pretend you're living there full time. Don't tell them that we're renting it out Airbnb, because we won't get as favorable terms on a loan. So this is a man, and this is now, we are now talking about 2016 when some of these things were happening. 2015, 2016, Trump is running for president. Manafort, it's around the time he's working on his campaign, and he is financially desperate. So the situation, the big picture situation we're seeing is Manafort's financially desperate. He is very linked to oligarchs, possible intelligence agents in Russia and the Ukraine. And in a lot of ways, it sort of sets the stage for what might be coming further. But it's an extraordinary thought that somebody was sort of bargaining his access to Trump. He was to try to sort of get loan forgiveness from some of the people that he owned money to that were foreign actors.
I brought an exhibit with me that dramatically illustrates that. This is an email that surfaced this week. This is from Paul Manafort to Rick Gates in April 2015. Rick Gates has just informed him his taxes are going to go up. Manafort writes, "Rick, I just saw this. WTF. How could I be blindsided like this? You told me you were on top of this. We need to discuss options. This is a disaster." You see the desperation. You don't actually need Rick Gates on the stand, because the documents alone tell a very, very rich story.
Richard in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Ilya Meretz, who is at the Manafort trial this week, and Andrea Bernstein, co-hosts of our Trump Inc. podcast. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. I'd like to hear Ilya's comments on the judge's demeanor. There was an article in the New York Times about how the judge, whose last name I think is Ellis, is dominating the trial, sarcastic, imperious, even accusing belittling one of the assistant U.S. attorneys, saying that he was crying. So I'd like to hear what Ilya has to say about that.
Yeah, I didn't get to see any tears the day that I was there, and maybe he was on better behavior on the big Rick Gates day, because he understood that a lot of people were going to be watching. But definitely Judge Ellis has clashed with the prosecutors very noticeably. He seems to be much more friendly to the defense team. And And this week there was a clash. I wasn't in the courtroom then, but there was a clash over whether an IRS audit agent who was going to be called as a witness, it turned out he had been watching the entire proceeding. He'd been watching the entire trial. And when the judge found out about that, he kind of flipped out on the prosecutors, and the prosecutors came back and said, "We told you, and you said that was okay." And overnight, Mueller's team actually asked the judge to tell the jury to disregard what he had said earlier, basically to say, okay, it's fine to have a witness who has been watching the entire proceeding. It has been tense.
That's weird. Does that indicate that the judge is biased against the Mueller team, against the prosecution?
I know an attorney who is frequently in that courthouse who said that lawyers whose cases are assigned to Judge Ellis often groan or are unhappy, but it's because he has a reputation for being ornery, not because he has a reputation for being unfair.
I think that is true. I mean, I think the judges always sort of establish relationships with the jury. Like, there's this sort of axis going on in a courtroom, and this judge has been joking with the jury about their lunch, about the fact that they're not getting baked Alaska.
Every day.
When I was there during jury selection, and at one point he says to them, okay, I hope you're not slitting your wrists that you're on this jury now. So he jokes about his wife and his, you know, fact that he doesn't send emails. Jurors are very inclined to take their cues from judges. And mm-hmm. I think the concern from the special counsel, who has now filed two motions asking the judge to retract some of his comments, is that the jury is going to somehow take the message that their case is not to be believed, that they should be extra skeptical. And, you know, when the Mueller released his evidence list, I was like, wow, this is a slam dunk case. And I think now there's a lot of uncertainty because of this element of skepticism the judge has introduced.
And in fairness, we have not yet seen how the judge behaves toward the defense when the defense mounts its case beginning next week. But just one other example, according to a Bloomberg transcript, Judge Ellis seemed to accuse Greg Andres, the prosecutor, of crying in his courtroom. On Monday, the judge said, "I understand how frustrated you are. In fact, there's tears in your eyes right now." And when Andres denied the judge's claim, the judge said, "Well, they're watery." What's the point of that?
I think it's to establish dominance. I mean, that was out of the hearing of the jury. There's this white noise machine in the courtroom that goes like, shh, whenever the judge is having a bench conference, so you can't hear what's being said. However, some of it is entered into the transcript, but the jury is not hearing it said. So it's sort of like, this is my courtroom, I set the rules, is the consistent message. Now,
and it seems to be happening whichever government prosecutor is up. You know, it happened with Uzo Osonye, the first one. It happened again with Greg Andres. And so, I don't know.
We're going to take a break and continue with Ilya Marritz and Andrew Bernstein from our Trump Inc. podcast. Ilya was in the courtroom at the Manafort trial this week. We'll take more of your calls at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I definitely want to follow up, Andrea, on what you said a moment ago, that this looked like a slam dunk case with all the documentary evidence about Paul Manafort's alleged financial fraud. And that maybe now not so much, and the implications of how this turns out for what happens next with the Mueller investigation. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Marritz, co-hosts of our Trump Inc. podcast. Ilya was in the Manafort trial courtroom this week. Andrea, you said, and I've heard this from other observers too, that it looked like a slam dunk case going in against Manafort. Now, because of the Gates testimony, casting doubt on a number of things, and including his own credibility as a star witness, maybe not so much. What are you seeing, and what are the implications of that for the Trump investigation, the larger Russia, you know, the potential collusion and obstruction of justice investigations?
Yeah, I just want to say I've sort of moved from, like, wow, it looks good for the special counsel, to sort of question mark. But the evidence that they have introduced is very strong. I mean, they're trying to prove a tax fraud and a bank fraud case. They're trying to prove that Paul Manafort made income, that he transferred in to pay for all the things, the suits, the houses in Soho and Brooklyn, et cetera, and did it in a certain way to avoid paying taxes on the IRS. And they have documentation of all these loans. They have the IRS testifying. Same thing for the bank fraud. They have people who were granted immunity to come forward because they themselves may have committed crimes and going along with Paul Manafort. They have his ex-accountant, who is no Rick Gates, saying, you know, I knew I shouldn't have done it, but he was a big client, so I did. So there's still a lot of evidence. The defense is really wants, I think, the jury to the argument that they're trying to make is, if you don't believe Rick Gates, you shouldn't convict Paul Manafort. And what the special counsel is trying to say is, well, there's all this other stuff. So even though we know he's a liar and a criminal, you should not just discount everything because there is corroboration. So that, I expect, is what we'll hear in closing arguments. But what does it mean? I mean,
let me cut to the chase here. The political analysts on cable have been spending a fair amount of time speculating, if Mueller loses this case, will Trump then see a political window to fire Rosenstein and Mueller and shut down the whole thing?
It's very, very dangerous to predict the actions of the president. So I think that obviously it's bad for Mueller if he loses this case, because it's the first case and it gives credibility to what the president has been arguing, that it's a witch hunt. That said, there's another trial coming right after this one in Washington, D.C. for money laundering and conspiracy against the United States against Paul Manafort. So
right, this is the first of two trials.
I mean, it's very, very hard to know what Trump could do and what he could do it when. But I just think that obviously there's a lot riding on this case. And the special counsel knows it. They feel like the sort of history of this country depends on the outcome of the Manafort case.
So, Ilya, how much damage did Rick Gates do to the prosecution's case? He was their star witness, but maybe he winds up meaning more to the defense than the prosecution.
Yeah, I think he might. He kept his calm throughout. I mean, he really was not riled at any point, and I think that that served him well. In that respect, at least, he was a good witness for the prosecution. But I think his testimony really, in cross-examination, his testimony really dented the idea that Paul Manafort knew everything that was going on and was a micromanager, because what the defense attorneys were able to establish in questioning Rick Gates is that Rick Gates, he admitted stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from the accounts that he managed for Paul Manafort. Rick Gates clearly was the money guy. He was very often the frontline person setting up accounts in Cyprus, moving accounts to St. Vincent and the Grenadines, setting up companies in those places, trying to arrange bank loans. He was usually the frontline guy, even if he was acting on Paul Manafort's instructions. So defense lawyers may have raised some real doubts about just how much of this Paul Manafort was really directing and how much knowledge he had. They're going to try to argue that he just signed his name to a bunch of forms. I do think, though, that the paper record belies that. There are enough emails that say, Rick, what's going on? Make this problem go away. Fix this problem.
And there were quite a few witnesses that were asked, did you ever deal with Rick Gates? And they were like, no, I don't even know who he was. So
Manafort was responsible for much of his own financial misdealing.
Right. So what the defense is hoping is that the jury is going to think, well, all of that, you know, Rick Gates, the things he hid from Manafort are dispositive for everything. And what the special counsel is going to hope is that the jury is going to see that, okay, beyond that, if you look at all the evidence, including the testimony of Rick Gates, the email, the bank records, you know, they've had IRS agents, they've had FBI agents.
It's like 20 witnesses. It's a lot of people.
Right. There's a lot of people for the jury to just throw out beyond Rick Gates if they decide that it was all on Rick Gates.
John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, this is really making my head explode because you have a bunch of non-lawyers talking about what judges do and what lawyers do. Juries don't pay attention to any of this nonsense.
Are you a lawyer, just to establish?
I happen to be a lawyer. I happen to be a trial lawyer.
Okay.
And juries, first of all, you can't win a federal prosecution. I mean, the government always wins because they put on an overwhelming amount of evidence. The juries look at that overwhelming amount of evidence. They don't pay any attention to the cross-examination of the witnesses. They know they're bad guys because they're confederate to these people. They understand the way that, you know, and you folks are making mountains out of molehills here.
Wait, are you saying that there's not much doubt in your mind as a lawyer that the prosecution is going to win this case against Manafort?
You can never tell, but talk to criminal lawyers and find out how many acquittals they get. They don't get many unless they get a reversal on appeal because the judge really screwed up. And this judge, yeah, everybody deals with irascible judges. You know, it's part of the game. But the prosecutors have got their evidence in. The jury's going to look at the evidence, and they're going to see an. And when the prosecutors do the summation, they're going to lay out how they put in an overwhelming amount of physical evidence that Gates, whatever you say about him, has put in context. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to think that that Gates is a good guy. Sammy the Bull Gravano admitted to 20 murders, and John Gotti was still convicted.
Right. Gravano was a star witness.
Good point.
Against Gotti. John, counselor, thank you very much for your contribution.
It's a really good point. I do think, it's worth noting in this trial that perhaps different from other federal trials, that the judge has really limited prosecutors' ability to portray the defendant as a bad guy and as somebody who consorts with bad guys. Just one small example, the word oligarch has been more or less banned from the courtroom.
Why?
So when prosecutors talk about Paul Manafort's patrons, they're Ukrainian politicians or Ukrainian businessmen. Judge says they're not the ones on trial, so oligarch is a loaded term. I think it's a fair point, but that's you know, one word that's now not in their arsenal.
And there was that moment, was it that the defense was asking Gates if he was ever interviewed by the Mueller investigation about the Trump campaign?
That's right.
I would think that the Mueller people would like the public to know that the answer to that is yes, but the prosecution objected.
They immediately objected, and then there was a bench conference and a little break, and when court came back into session, there was no more mention of that. excuse me. And I think the reason is the judge doesn't want this to be about the Trump campaign. And I think prosecutors believe they have a very strong case just on the evidence that they have and what they have to prove. That's what they have to prove. Bank fraud, tax fraud.
But also, the defense is trying to say he's just trying to save his skin. So what they're trying to, I mean, and there was a lot of pretrial motions about this. The defense is trying to say, oh, here's Rick Gates. He's just as, you know, he's a terrible criminal. He was the actual mastermind. And you're letting him save his skin because he's cooperating with this crazy witch hunt that you have. I mean, they haven't obviously said it in those terms, mm-hmm. but that is the implication. And that is why I believe the prosecution said, no, you cannot raise this because we have all agreed that those topics, witch hunt and Trump campaign included, mm-hmm. are out.
Andy in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Yeah, so the thing that really strikes me is just like how flagrant this was, how it was going on from years. I mean, if we believe the evidence, and I feel like the consequences are way beyond Trump and Mueller. How many more Manafort-Fords are there? He was unlucky enough to get swept up in this Mueller investigation. But how many other agents for foreign countries are flagrantly taking money from oligarchs and dictators and autocrats who are not only corruptly running their own countries, but are properly running our country people like Manafort?
What a great question. And we do allow the word oligarch here, even if the judge doesn't yes. allow it in the courtroom.
Oligarch.
Andrew, I think this is your sweet spot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Paul Manafort actually founded a certain kind of political consulting where he was working for politicians at the same time he was working for people who wanted things from those politicians. And the person who helps somebody win a campaign, it's like the doctor that saved your life. It's like the candidate feels that they owe that person forever. So it's an immensely powerful position. That said, I suspect that there is an awful lot of tax fraud and possibly some bank fraud of the kind that we're seeing, and possibly some money laundering. The U.S. Treasury believes, I mean, Ilya and I spend a lot of time looking at these shell companies. Who are they? Who do they represent? And now we're seeing in the Manafort trial layer after layer after layer and how easy it is. And there was testimony this week of a guy named Dr. K in Cyprus, whose job it is to sort of set up all these accounts for people. There's a whole industry around it.
And Dr. K is still in business. I went to his website this week to check the spelling. They call him Dr. K because his name is hard to spell. Dr. Kypros Chrysostomidis. He's in business. Nice. And you can go to him now if you want to set up an offshore account, and he'll get you the forms, I'm sure.
But I think Andy's question, or at least what he's wondering about, is how many other Paul Manaforts out there representing how many other countries manipulating United States government policy through their influence on both sides?
I suspect he is not the only one. He may be a very blatant example, but you know, I think the problem is that we don't know how many people are secretly working for foreign powers because they're keeping it a secret. Some has come out. I mean, there's other people around Trump who are representing the interests of the Saudis or the Emiratis or other, you know, cases, Romania, Angola. There are definitely people who are taking money and trying to influence this presidency. And I think one of our projects in Trump Inc. is to try to understand how extensive that is and how different it is from what's happened in previous governments.
You know, but there were all these opportunities where I don't think Manafort was all that secret. He introduced himself to the U.S. Embassy when he got active in Kiev. We know that. We know that after the revolution there in 2014, when his client had to flee to Russia, the FBI came and interviewed Rick Gates and Paul Manafort specifically about their financial arrangements. They were forthcoming about those financial arrangements, Rick Gates said on the stand. So how come that didn't go anywhere? It was known to the government.
Well, I mean, looks like from this trial, we don't know.
So far as we know, it didn't go anywhere.
What was known when? But this whole document trail and the payment trail and the memos back and forth and the policy advice for a Ukrainian dictator who was at the time jailing his opponent. You're supposed to disclose these things. That's the law. And Paul Manafort didn't disclose them, not just to an FBI agent if they call you in, but you're supposed to publicly say, I am working for these people.
So the defense starts with its case next week. It might be very short, I hear. They might not even call any witnesses and just say, okay, jury, the prosecution failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt its case. And so we'll see Monday what happens with that. We just have like a minute and a half left. And Andrea, I want to get your quick thought on another headline outside of this case. There's a secret recording acquired by MSNBC of House Intelligence Chairman Republican Devin Nunes where he discusses the Russia probe at a fundraiser. And of course, he's been the lead actor in Congress trying to take Trump's side that this is all a witch hunt. But in this recording, just 18 seconds of which we're going to play, he says the Republicans should protect Trump from the special counsel's Russia investigation so they don't lose the House. Listen carefully, folks. This is very off mic, but I'll read the transcript after we listen to Nunes himself.
If Sessions won't unrecuse and Mueller won't clear the president, we're the only ones, which is really the danger. That's why I'm thanking you for saying it, by the way. I mean, we have to keep all these things. We have to keep the majority. If we do not keep the majority, all of this goes away.
Here's the transcript. If Sessions won't unrecuse and Mueller won't clear the president, we're the only ones, which is really in danger. That's why I keep, and thank you for saying it, by the way, I mean, we have to keep all these seats. We have to keep the majority. If we do not keep the majority, all of this goes away. Andrea, oh my goodness, Devin Nunes has just about admitted he's taking the president's side in the Russia investigation as a purely political act to help them keep the majority in Congress.
Well, It's always interesting when you hear these things, but all of his public actions are entirely consistent with that position, so no one should be surprised. I mean, there were many witnesses that were not called as part of the House investigation. They've worked hard to keep it secret. We know, I mean, at one point he himself was recused because of these sketchy contacts with White House officials, and maybe they gave him some evidence that maybe he gave out to people. He has been acting in public as if it's his job to raise doubts about the Mueller investigation. He's been acting like a defense attorney, frankly.
And he says in this tape, why? We have to keep all these seats. We have to keep the majority.
Right. And that appears to be the game, that it's all about the politics of this, which shouldn't shock us because the House investigation in particular seems to shy away every time it gets near the truth. And then they have this sort of parallel investigation into the FBI, into Mueller, raising doubt. Just like we were talking about a second ago, the defense lawyers raising doubt about Rick Gates. They're saying, don't think about Mueller. Look about all these other things that are possibly corrupt, because it appears they're trying to clear the president so that they can retain their own power and control.
Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Marritz, co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Never a dull moment on Trump Inc. Thank you, guys.
Sadly, no.
Thank you, Brian.